Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Hi folks, I once again have the pleasure of being joined by Rupert Lowe MP, and we are going to be talking about his Restore Britain movement and anything else that comes up in the conversation that's pertinent.
I'm sure there'll be a lot, Carl.
No doubt. So do you want to tell everyone how Restore Britain's going at the moment?
Yep, we launched it just over a week ago, and it's going better than we could have hoped. People are signing up to both classes of membership, so they're signing up to the normal membership, and they're signing up to the Cromwell Club. We've had a great response to the Cromwell Club as well, which, as you know, is named after my dog.
Oh, that's good to know.
Who caused some controversy recently, so we thought it was a very apt name. Mm. So those people who are members of the Cromwell Club will get to have dinner with me once a year. Lucky people.
Oh, yes.
So it's going very well. I think, as you know, the situation with Restore Britain is I decided I didn't think a party was the right route to take, for the simple reason that I think a party creates further division. Mm-hmm. And I think what we now need, those of us who want our country back, what we want is unity. Mm. So it doesn't matter what your politics are. I think whether we agree with each other or not, we share a love of Britain, because when it's working well, it's a fantastic place. We all know it's dysfunctional now. We all know it's been taken over by all sorts of malign forces. We can feel it every day slipping through our fingers. So I wanted to unite everybody, and I'm surprised that we haven't had a rush of 17.4 million people who voted to take their country back in 2016, despite the government advising them to do the opposite, for which they are being punished by a very sort of malevolent European Union. It would have been very easy to respect the democratic vote of the British people, to continue to trade with us freely, to make it easy to respect that decision. But no, their club is a post-war socialist malign club that basically has to keep their members hemmed in, rather like communism had to put a wall up. Because I think a lot of people will break out the sides in the end. I'm sure it'll happen in our lifetimes. I'm not quite sure when.
You can already see it.
You can sort of feel it. Sort of feel it happening.
Well, the Schengen zone is already basically falling apart, isn't it?
France is bust. I mean, you know, it's all looking very fragile. Mm. So I think my reason for setting up Restore Britain is that I want to unify, and I want to unify those people who know we're losing our country, who care deeply about the country. And it's the only way I could see of, number one, achieving that at the next election. But most importantly, before that, if we get enough members, we can start to influence the way in which the country goes, because it's going badly wrong every day. Mm. And we've had some very bad economic figures out this morning, with the recipe of higher taxes, more state intervention, higher wages and higher pensions for public sector workers. Trust me, that is not a recipe for a growing economy.
Somehow, we still haven't learned the lesson. You can't tax people into prosperity.
No, you can't.
Let me ask you a question then. So I agree.
It's like you can't regulate for growth, which Rachel Reeves seems to think you can. Oh. You deregulate for growth. And you cannot regulate for growth.
And these are well-tested economic questions as well. It's not like the numbers aren't in on either side of the question. But let me ask you, because a lot of people, I think, are very fond of the idea of what you're doing with Restore Britain. Obviously, I am, which is why you're here promoting it with me. But I think that there is the question of... I agree with your premise that if we don't get a handle on this by 2029... I don't think the country's finished, but it's just going to be so much more difficult to restore.
Look, there are many good things about Britain.
But well, hang on.
I think we shouldn't be too negative.
No, I agree. But
the bedrock of Britain is great still.
Yes, but it's about when you're sliding down the slippery slope. The sooner you arrest that descent, the better, right? And 2029. I think you've actually said is, you know, kind of been our last opportunity to properly turn the ship around.
It may not be. It may be before 29.
Well, yeah.
Because I always say, ultimately, democracy is fragile. We know that. Democracy is not the norm. Autocracy is the norm. And if your economy goes wrong, democracy is always under threat. So I think we're going to see the economy go badly wrong. I think the chalk jockeys, as I call them, who are in charge of our front bench, haven't got a clue what they're doing. No. So they're gonna stumble around, and in the end, they're gonna cause huge amounts of damage. As my grandfather always said, more damage is done by well-meaning idiots than people who are out and out bad. And that's what's going on in on the front bench. So I actually think if the economy turns down, the election could come a lot sooner than people think.
I agree. And
why there's urgency to what we're doing. We need to get this unified, this unified view. And again, let me just give people an example. So in Parliament, I sit up with Jeremy Corbyn and the Muslim Independent MPs, and we all get along famously. In fact, the Speaker said, I see you lot making a hell of a lot of noise, and you probably saw Mohammed Iqbal giving Nigel a bit of the old A, be joyful at Prime Minister's questions, getting a bit overexcited about it. And he did apologise, to his credit. But we don't agree, but we are Democrats, I think, and we want to have a country in which you respect other people's views, but you can disagree with them.
Yes.
And I disagree vehemently with Jeremy Corbyn's views, but I'd rather debate with Jeremy Corbyn than I would with Keir Starmer, because I don't think Keir Starmer knows good from bad, black from white.
I don't think he's a Democrat.
I don't think he's got a clue what is right and what is wrong.
I think Keir Starmer views democracy as the problem, frankly, to the managerial order. But the issue...
Well, he's a Fabian. It's all about the Fabian agenda.
He absolutely is. Look up the logo of the Fabian Society, by the way.
Wolf in sheep's clothing.
Yeah, oh, you spoiled it. But yeah, it's crazy how that was actually their logo until some like 30 years ago, because they were like, hang on, does this make us look bad? But the question is, that people have been putting to me, and I don't have a good answer for this, is, okay, well, we agree that we need to do something by 2029. An election rolls around, and we're on board with the Restore Britain mission. How exactly does Restore Britain take power?
Well, I think if we get the movement to be as big as I would like it to be, and I think there is an urgency, and I do hope people will...
Can you give me a number?
...will sign up. Well, I mean, we need to go well through 100,000 and head up towards a million. As I say, 17.4 million people have not had Brexit, so they ought to be sufficiently irritated to spend, as I call it, the amount of two pints in the wrong pub. You can spend a tenner on a pint in London now quite easily. As I say, my country, my responsibility, or our country, our responsibility. And if we want it back, we've got to get together. Because what's happened is a little elite has taken over, and it's not operating in the interests of the British people. I think the state has become the enemy. And that doesn't matter whether, you know, what part of the state it is. The state is serving itself. It's not serving the people. So for the people to take it back, we need a big movement. I don't have a number as big as possible. So you say you can't quite see where it's going to go. I don't think we know exactly where it's going to go. But what I do know is with a movement, all the options are open.
Right.
So we could do a reverse takeover of the Tory party. We could do a reverse takeover of reform. We might set up our own party, but that's a huge undertaking. Or if we see a development which effectively gives us comfort that we found a solution to how we're going to better govern the country, we could align ourselves with those people. So I think the most important thing in a country which has been run on a poll every week, so a poll, you know, Tony Blair started this polling, which I don't agree with, because I like to run the country on principle, not on a poll. And, you know, if you subscribe to the book, the Mackay book about the popular delusions and the madness of crowds, the crowd is always wrong. And as he said, you know, people slowly get back their sense one by one, but it doesn't happen as a collective. And you see that on the football terraces and everything else. But
you know, I could argue that point, because there are studies that show actually crowds have a kind of innate sort of self-calibrating mechanism. When people perceive a lot of people are going that way, they'll tend to go the other way just to balance things out.
But football crowds have a great sense of humour. I like that. Their collective sense of humour is very good. But anyway,
yeah.
So I think for me, that's where I think, and the bigger we get, the more influence we have, and not just at the election, we'll start to have influence now. Like we had a petition on the ridiculous Lucy Connolly sentence. And we got to 100,000 very quickly. We've now got a debate in Westminster Hall. I don't think that we've got a scheduled date yet, but we've been notified it's going to happen. In the same way we had a debate on Halal Meat. So if we've got over 100,000 members, we can arguably, with our Direct Democracy app, and I'm intent on trying to involve our followers more directly in the policy that we come out with. And the policies that we're coming out with at the moment are putative policies, which we've trailed on X a lot, and we're now just formalizing them. And then once we've got our Direct Democracy app, I would like people to play a part in, what policies we push forward, what private prosecutions we pursue, what judicial reviews we might consider. So I think as a movement, then, we start to get power. And as you know, our elite are tarts. They basically respond to votes. And the more of us there are who are putting common sense forward, the more they can't ignore those people. Mm. Whereas at the moment, I think the individual, they've oppressed us by basically making us work harder and harder, fill in more and more forms, whether that's, to collect pensions and gift wrap it to the state, whether it's to collect national insurance and gift wrap it to the state, whether it's to collect VAT and gift wrap it to the state, whether it's to deal with health and safety regulations, whatever. They have effectively burdened people with all this, and they've turned them into slaves. And if you read The Road to Serfdom by Hayek, which I'm sure we both have, you can see it's all there. Mm-hmm. Or if you read Ayn Rand, read Atlas Shrugged, it's all in there. So I think we the bedrock of common sense and decency, we need to gather together now and we need to fight these forces. And I respect the fact if people are happy with the way their lives are at the moment and they think their country's in rude health, fine. I'll go back and start drinking some even better red wine by my swimming pool after the next election. Mm. It may not even be in this country, because I actually can't see that this country will be a good place to live. I think it's got all the hallmarks of a country which basically had probably the greatest empire in the world during the Victorian period. But you often find that empires can go very badly wrong. It's usually not when they hand over power, which we did to the Americans. It's usually the second time that power changes, and we're close to that. So we're close to the power, I think, changing from the US. You can see the hallmarks again of US power, which was completely omnipotent. It's now beginning to crack, and you've got, the question now is who takes over from the US? Can it be China with its sort of, what I call faux capitalist society? It's a sort of blend of authoritarianism and capitalism.
China is actually resembling fascism.
So could it be China? Could it be, I don't know, India? Could it be? It's going to be, somebody is going to assume that role, and it's going to be a huge change. Now, very often, the empire, not the one who, it's two goes ago, so it could be us, they implode. So we may implode, we may go rotten. Well, that's why I want to get this movement together, because I still think there are some great people out there. And what we need to do is unite.
I agree, but I think the I think people would understandably be more reassured if they knew what the concrete plan was. Now, I'm personally quite happy to muddle through. I've never really had a plan. I've always just got on with things, and here we are. So I actually understand the.
Well, if you want a concrete plan, Carl, start a party.
Oh, well.
Then you have to have a concrete plan. We're a movement. So yes. I think what we want to do is start involving people, get them to feel what it's like to have a sort of movement which consults and considers them, not a state which basically goes off plowing its own furrow and enriching itself at the expense of the people.
Okay.
So I think we've got, that's the only way I could see we could create unity. And that's the purpose of this. The lightning rod, if you like, for those people who are concerned about their country. Now they may not respond, and if they don't, it'll fizzle out and come to nothing. But the more people we have is the most important thing, mm-hmm. the more financial ammunition we have. And as I've said to you, I've spent quite a lot of my own money to get to where we are. I think we've now got a chance of changing things. And the most important development was probably getting into Parliament. The bridgehead that reform created, and I played my part in that, I think was incredibly significant to retaining our democracy.
So let's talk about some of the policies that Restore Britain have been advertising on Twitter, because I have to say I'm in. I like a lot.
We haven't been advertising. We've been feeding them in.
Yeah.
For consideration. So they're like putative policies.
Yeah, I mean... But
they're nothing I haven't put on X before.
Of course, but it's nice to formalise them, right? So, for example, in fact, I can't think of a single party that wants a net negative immigration policy in the country. Because, of course, the country is wildly overpopulated, as you found travelling here this morning. There's just too many
Swindon people. Swindon is not necessarily a particularly good example of that. It's very crowded, isn't it?
It's incredibly crowded.
And the traffic system is not great either.
Well, it was fine 10 years ago, you know, but we've had something like 30 or 40,000 new people live here now. And so we are just feeling just, you know, like we're in a pressure cooker. But this is a problem that most of the country is experiencing. There's just too many people here. And so really, and if the answer to any of the problems we had was more people, well, we've had 15 million new people come into the country. Are we suddenly finding ourselves with a dearth of problems? No.
Look, this, I don't know what you think, but I haven't seen the detail of this one in, one out deal with, you know, between Keir Starmer and Macron, but it looks to me like the French, as usual, have come out on top.
Well, yes, Keir Starmer is the worst deal maker.
It seems like the worst deal I've ever seen on the face of it, but I don't think the details yet been released.
Well, you say that, but the Chagos Islands deal was worse. Well, the Gibraltar deal was worse.
That was let's give away what we've already got and then pay to rent it back. Yeah. I mean, most people in commerce would just know that's completely an utter insanity.
I would never sign a deal like that. But the point being, the net negative immigration is far stronger than anything else on the right at all. Like the Conservative Party is very mealy-mouthed about this, and the Reform Party wants a net zero immigration policy, so one in, one out, again, like with Keir Starmer's deal. But that leaves us in exactly the same position we are now, which is a problem. We need fewer people in the country. Right?
What we need, I think, Carl, is fewer people in the country. We need more people integrating. So yes. If people come here, they must integrate. They must accept our culture. So we will be, and I think our supporters will be quite clear on this. So I don't think intellectually I'm against immigration. Targeted immigration for high-skilled people who are going to add to our economy, that's what we need. What we don't need is people who are going to come here, and the stats prove this, and become a burden on the British taxpayer. And not integrate in our society and start to agitate for their own Sharia courts or whatever other courts it is. You know, I think, you know, can you imagine us going to one of the countries in the Middle East and starting to demand that we had our own courts and everything else? They just tell us to get lost.
Well, this is the constant.
We may be victims of the fact that we have been historically a very high trust society. And the problem I think we've now got is that with all the immigrants who come in, I'm not sure you can necessarily apply that high trust society to everybody who's come here, because they don't quite understand the way in which it operates.
Well, I would suggest you can't do that, actually.
So I would obviously, the immigration has to stop.
Yeah.
And we have to, as I've always said, we have to deport those people who are coming here illegally, living here illegally. We have to deport foreign criminals in our prisons straight away. And we have to use all the tools that we can. You know, this ridiculous foreign aid budget. If people don't comply, then cut the foreign aid off. I mean, when are we going to start to employ a bit of Victorian rail politik, which is what effectively made us so well respected throughout the world?
I am absolutely up for a return to gunboat diplomacy when it comes to returning illegals. No, you're taking them back, is what I would say.
Well, can you call yourself a sovereign nation if you can't defend your own borders?
No, not at all.
And, you know, I the Liberals, the Emily Maitlises of this world, get very upset when I say we should put them on either a Scottish or an English island off the coast, so that they come here, they get a tented camp, they get some food, they're not badly treated. But when they decide they want to go home, a bit like Australia, Australia's got the formula. It's very easy. You've got Nauru Island.
Yeah, they did exactly.
They go this. There till they decide they want to go home. Yeah. And then that's fine. We'll help them go home. But, yeah. And as I say, you know, the Scots get upset when I say a Scottish island. I only say that because the variety of midge in Scotland is rather better than the one in England. But
also, they have uninhabited islands. Like, what are you complaining about? There's no one living there.
They're uninhabited islands, and but they're far enough away, so trying to get to the mainland is treacherous.
Okay,
so look, if you come here illegally, and I have this very interesting view, which is as a result of what happened to me, that the sort of false accusations that were made against me. And I've sort of learned quite a lot now about our law, and to actually support or help somebody who's breaking the law is in itself illegal.
Yes.
So I've got this very interesting concept for people to consider, which is border patrol are helping illegal migrants, or illegal economic migrants, as I call them,
yep.
to enter our country illegally. Now, arguably, they are aiding and abetting somebody who is perpetrating something illegal. Therefore, they are breaking the law themselves. Now, nobody's actually brought this up, but that is effectively what's happening. So our government is aiding and abetting people who are breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
Now, equally, we know there are people living here illegally, and they're doing nothing about finding and deporting those people who, by the way, find it very easy to get work, who undermine the honest, decent, tax-paying citizens, because there are those people who are unscrupulous enough to employ these people. And I personally think there should be huge penalties for companies who get caught employing illegal migrants and paying them at less than the minimum wage. Should be a massive fine. Mm. Should be all sorts of, you know, censure on being a director of a company and everything else. We should be protecting those people who are working honestly, collecting and paying their taxes, and not allow them to be undermined by this vast black economy which is growing up.
So I agree with all of that, obviously. But I think a lot of people will notice how you've moved to focusing on the illegal immigrants, which are, of course, a problem. But I think a greater problem is the amount of legal immigration that was allowed, because just that people never wanted it. They never voted it. And every time they had the opportunity, they voted for a party whose manifesto was, we won't increase immigration.
Well, we were told constantly that immigration would be cut.
Yes, exactly.
But Cameron, Boris, May, they all presided over legal immigration. And legal immigration is more difficult. And contrary to what Farage said, I've never talked about repatriation. Repatriation is a much more difficult subject. The first thing is to deal with those people who are here illegally, those people who arrive illegally, and those foreign criminals who've broken the law, who are in our prisons, clogging up the prison system. Thereafter, and you're probably seeing what's happening in Sweden, Sweden were probably the most liberal country. They accepted a lot of migrants into the country legally.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had the most terrible trouble as a result. And now they are paying to repatriate those people who've undermined their society in terms of some of their cities are no longer safe. They used to be incredibly safe. And as you know, the Nordics as a people are wonderful people. They're again, polite, very liberal, very decent people.
Dramatic
but I think constants. Even they now can see the damage, the sort of irreparable damage in many respects, which has happened. I think cities like Malmo are almost sort of, you know, almost you can't live there.
Well, it's the grenade capital of Europe.
Yeah.
So
look, why don't we learn?
Well,
we learn?
This is what people would want to know, because I think your framing is correct. I mean, obviously, if you know, there's a handful of tech entrepreneurs that we want to come and set up AI manufacturing or whatever it is in London or something like that, fine. But that's not been the British experience with immigration. So if we were to reduce immigration into targeted skill-based immigration, then that's going to be tens of thousands a year. And
I don't know what you think, Carl, but I sort of innately think with QE and with the undermining and debasing of what I call, you know, paper currencies, which are not backed by anything, and actually they're no good for anything. They're only They only exist if people trust in them.
Yep.
People are losing trust in them, and you're actually seeing, you know, you're seeing cryptocurrencies and, you know, other forms of barter and trade, which are springing up alongside mm-hmm. it. Because I do think probably the central banking system is fundamentally fraudulent. And I think a lot of, I don't know what they're doing.
It's
you
a large.
You don't know what yeah. they're doing, but a lot of what I see economically now doesn't add up.
Oh, yeah.
So the point I'm coming to is, isn't brain power going to ultimately be the global currency? And, yes. and we can see it now. So the last thing we want is vast numbers of low-grade workers who, because AI is going to take care of a lot of that. What we need is a high-trust society based on intellect, based on a respect of the law, based on integration. And if you can find people who want to come to live in the country, who are going to bring this kind of enterprise. And by the way, at the moment, we're doing our very best to put people off investing and taking risk. Because, you know, I can tell you for a fact that HMRC are pre-approving various EIS schemes. People are then investing and having pre-approved it, they're then resiling on it. So you can't trust the state now. The state says all these wonderful things about how it's going to foster enterprise, but then it doesn't deliver it.
But just to...
Because it's a predator.
I mean, I completely...
It wants the money.
I completely agree. And the Labour Party has shown that whatever their plans were, they're just not working and they're just ruining us. But the I agree with you that, yeah, if there are particularly specialised people, but that, I think, by definition, will be a low number of people. Right, that would have to be
tiny.
Yeah, and so the issue is that the last conservative successive governments have decided to actually flood us with low skilled immigrants or who people are just outright dependents on the state. They've done this legally though, right? So these people are here legally. What ought we to do to encourage these people to return home?
Well, first we'll deal with the illegals, as we say, and the criminals, and then and then we need to find some formula. And again, I don't have the answer, but Sweden are doing it. It seems to be working in Sweden. There are other countries who repatriate legally and encourage people to go.
Well, I've got an idea on this. I think we don't need to worry about repatriation. All we need to do is just turn off the benefits, I think.
Well, the benefits have to stop.
Yes.
I mean, Macron, whilst, you know, I when asked about the French, I mean, historically, the French have been our enemy usually, and I think my view is that they probably still are.
Yes.
But, you know, Macron did come up with some very sensible comments, which is... Yep. You are the architects of your own problems because
you're giving them free money.
Giving them too much when it's too much of an. I think he used the word El Dorado. I think he said it's El Dorado for them.
But it absolutely is. And when you
in a way, you can't blame them if you come and then when they find the streets are paved with gold, they keep coming in bigger numbers.
And they put it on TikTok and then they're back at home. They see they're giving them free money. And so the view I have is that. Obviously, if you were born outside of this country, you should just not be entitled to any benefits in the country.
I agree.
And the benefits should be entirely for British citizens, born and bred. Right? And then that doesn't seem controversial.
To people who, after a predetermined period, say 10 years, if they can show they've paid tax and contributed, then fine. But until then, you should not be treated...
As a sort of basic ground level, if you come from overseas, you just don't get benefits.
Well, you're not a member of the club.
Well, exactly. And so it's, you know, because I mean, we're at a point now where we're paying billions and billions every year to foreigners to live here. And it's like, well, why are we doing this? This is crazy. And if we didn't do that, they'd go home, I think. So I think that's got to be the first.
I think you're right.
I think that's got to be the first thing that any sensible government does is turn off the tap. Okay, let's go on to the next thing that caught my eye, because this is a drum I've been banging for quite a while. And it's a restoration of the death penalty.
Yeah, in extreme circumstances.
Of course, of course. So I've been arguing this point for quite a while, and you are the only parliamentarian who is saying this. And this is something that, when polled, the British public, still half of them still want the death penalty restored. And that's just if you ask Do you want the death penalty restored? They'll just say, half of them would say yes, of course. But when you change the question and say, well, do you think that terrorists should get the death penalty? It goes up into the 60s and, you know, nearly reaching 70% of people saying, of course we should. Because we've got some core examples. Obviously, Rudy Cabana is a great example.
Well, Rudy Cabana was the chap, or Rudy Cabana, whatever he's called.
Yeah.
He was the person, one of the people we had in mind when you say in extreme cases. I mean, look, historically, when we had the death penalty, there obviously were miscarriages of justice, as indeed there are today, not with the same consequence, because there's no death penalty. But I mean, still, people are locked up as innocent and found to be innocent. So the system is quite flawed, and I do think the judiciary, if you read the adult court bench book, which is the guidance for magistrates and people, it's basically started to embed all this DEI and woke into it. So you've got a judiciary, I think, which is going off the rails. And you know, I spoke in Parliament last week about the dangers of abandoning the jury trial, which ultimately is embedded into the Sixth Amendment. So the simple reason is there to protect the people.
So just as a quick thing on this, I've actually done quite a lot of research on the death penalty because I find it, I think it's important, right? So,
but in exceptional circumstances, I personally think it's a good thing.
Well, the thing is, what's interesting is historically, we had the death penalty on the books during the era that's called the Bloody Code. There were something like 220 offences that could have been worthy of the death penalty. However, treason was one of them, and that, notice Tony Blair took that off. But because the decision was made by the jury, often it was the jury that decided, no, this person, he did something wrong, but we're not going to give him the death penalty because of mitigating circumstances, because you needed a unanimous vote for the death penalty. So actually, in Britain, only a few hundred people a year would end up getting the death penalty. And in some regions, you just get no one for decades who had the death penalty.
Yeah.
And most of it was in London, obviously, because London, big city, you know, there's a lot of crime and there's, you know, a lot of problems. So you get about 200 people a year in London. But for the rest of the country, mostly nothing, or one or two a year. And it was, you know, people who truly deserved it, really, really horrific people. And that was back in an era where forensic science was simply not at the level that we have it now. So, for example, philosophically, there are two ways of justifying things. You've got fallibly or infallibly. Fallibly means it could be some other way, right? It could be, well, I think it's this, but there could be a circumstance where I'm wrong about that. But infallible justification is where it can't be any other way. And a great example of this is the Lee Rigby murderers, right?
Yep.
Where they're in broad daylight, they run him down, murder the man, stand around with the blood on their hands saying, this is why we've done it. It can't be any other people. There's no one else we could ascribe that murder
to. Same with Rudy Cabana.
Same with Rudy Cabana, right? He's literally caught in the act, in the middle of doing it. It couldn't be anyone else. And in those cases, well, I think there's a very strong argument for the death penalty.
Well, that hiding their crime was not part of their agenda, so
absolutely.
It was quite clear.
Absolutely.
Why would you continue to allow them at the cost of the British state to...
There's no
and
one
in Rudy Cabana's case, I think I'm right in saying he threw some boiling water or...
Oh, in prison, yeah.
Oil fat over one of the prison guards. Well, that should never be allowed to happen either.
No. And so the argument for the death penalty is actually very strong in these sort of narrow cases. And I can completely agree with, the average liberal to say, but what about if we're not entirely sure? And actually, fine. If we're not entirely sure, then of course don't apply the death penalty. But in those cases where we are entirely sure, why wouldn't we?
That's why we put it forward. Now, we've had a few people... And I say to them, they don't agree. I said, well, you're not going to agree with every policy, but you'll have a chance to have your say on it.
Yep.
And then, you know, this is what we want to truly form is a sort of policy platform. And you know, which is democratic, which does give people a say, which does involve them in the decision making. This is part of the problem, I think, is people in the country aren't really properly consulted. The MPs who are supposed to represent them have no power. They've been turned into eunuchs. The power lies with the parliamentary staff and the permanent secretaries. It doesn't lie with the elected assembly. So that's why we're trying to introduce a more direct democratic process. And I hope is that as we show that we can do this, more people will sign up and more people will believe in it. And then eventually, if we do attain some form of power and influence, they will have more of a say. And that's ultimately what we're trying to achieve.
So can we?
But I mean, on death penalty, we put it in, we push it. But some people don't like it. Fine.
I
said to him, you're not going to agree with every policy.
Yeah, and I, for example, I'm friends with Lawrence Fox, and I saw him opposing it, and I didn't start arguing the case with him, but I understand why. But I think that we can actually finesse this in such a way that we do actually only target those people where there's just simply no doubt.
I mean, my favourite is an Englishman same as his castle.
Oh, yeah. I was going to come on to
yeah,
that.
That's a big one for me. I honestly, this nonsense of...
Oh, yeah.
If somebody breaks into your house, threatens your family and your property, and they end up getting hurt, as far as I'm concerned...
What were you doing in my house?
That's their problem. You shouldn't be in their house.
Exactly. I've got...
Now we don't want to get to the stage... that we have in America where people knock on the door and get shot through the front door.
That's a bit much, yeah.
That's a bit much. But I mean, what we should accept is that you shouldn't be breaking in and damaging other people's interests and threatening their well-being.
Well, just the very fact that you broke into my house means, and like this is a sort of an old point that John Locke makes. It's like, well, since you've decided that these laws don't apply to you, what other laws have you decided don't apply to you going forward? I can't take a risk. So actually, if you are trying to rob me or if you've broken into my house, I've got every right to kill you because I don't know what your intentions
are. It always used to be the case. But
absolutely.
Now, you know, you see these terribly sort of distressing scenes of people who defended themselves being arrested. I honestly think the whole thing is bonkers.
The worst one I ever saw was that some burglar had broken into someone's house, tripped over and hurt his back on the table or something, and he sued the guy whose house he had broken into. And I was just like, okay, no, this is insufferable.
Now we come back to the law. I mean, you know, it's the same on my farm. Somebody can fall in my lake and drown, and I'm held accountable. They shouldn't be there in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, unless you have to now put signs up to say, warning, deep water.
Dear burglars, be careful.
I mean, what a nonsense, isn't it?
It's preposterous. And I completely agree with the framing. An Englishman's home is his castle. If you break into my house, I'm going to kill you. Like, I've got four kids in my house, you know. So if I went downstairs and found some guy in my kitchen or something like that, I'd go ballistic.
Yeah, I agree.
And I think rightfully so, right? Because, I mean, I don't know.
He shouldn't be there. Well, she shouldn't be there.
How dare you be in my house? This is my house, not yours. You know you shouldn't be there. Anything that happens to you after that is, as far as I'm concerned, you've consented to it, frankly.
Yeah.
So that's another great policy initiative. And I agree with these things on not just sort of like a practical level as well. Like I think that's got genuine sort of moral implications for how the country is governed and whose interest the country is governed in. Because to say, oh, you can't actually, you're not allowed to hurt a burglar who breaks into your house. Well, that doesn't help me at all. That just helps the burglar. And actually, I don't think we should be helping him.
Well, I just think the whole system is skewed at the moment towards the miscreant, not towards the honest taxpaying citizen. And that must 100%. Be wrong. That must be wrong in every respect.
I mean, I'm going to declare that that's wrong because I'm an honest taxpaying citizen. So I'm completely against that kind of system.
Well, don't you think people feel that?
I think they feel it, and I think we've come to a point where the country is a lot more radical than the politicians are. Actually,
oh yeah,
I have conversations with taxi drivers, people in pubs, and they're just like, and honestly, a lot of people have lost a lot of faith in the democratic system, and wouldn't be upset with radical action. Now, obviously, I'm not suggesting radical action, but the point is, if the mood of the country has shifted to that point, then we've got to do something. So,
I think we have to ask ourselves, don't you? Why would the state try and create that situation? Would an honest state not protect its decent, law-abiding, tax-paying citizens? So you have to ask yourself, does that mean the state is corrupt itself?
Yes, and yes.
That is the question we have to ask ourselves, and I hope it's not the case, but
there's actually... So I'm a philosopher, and there's a lot of philosophical thought that goes into this, and actually Nietzsche is one of the most interesting on this, where essentially the larger and more powerful the state becomes, the more tolerant it becomes of society's parasites. And it says, well, why should I do something about them? I can just tolerate them. I can just carry them with me. But moreover, if I was to do something, why would I punish them as if they've done something wrong? Why wouldn't I just render them harmless? isn't it enough to render them harmless? It's like, no, because that isn't moral, right? That is utilitarian. That is to say, well, they're not hurting me, so it's not a problem. It's like, okay, but you're not enforcing an affirmative moral order here.
Mm-hmm.
No, we punish them to enforce our morality upon them. You know, we are literally in the sort of Foucauldian paradigm. We are oppressing them with our moral standards.
Well, it's rather like bringing children up.
Yes.
If you try and bring them up to imbue them with the right.
Yes.
Well, the knowledge of what is right and what is wrong. And that's the job of a parent. That's, again, one of the things we strongly believe in is the family and the family unit. And therefore, a bit like Lee Kuan Yew did in Singapore, you reward the family unit, you promote the family unit, you support the family unit. And now we've got Singapore with a GDP per capita of twice ours, which when I used to go there in the mid-80s, it was still very much a rudimentary economy, sort of sitting on the tip of Malaysia.
Look at Poland. Poland's GDP is skyrocketing, and Poland has protectionist pro-family policies.
Poland's a good country.
That's a great country. And I'm jealous, frankly, of Poland and the way that the government is actually taking care of their country. And I wish our government...
Well, even Viktor Orban, who gets very bad publicity, he's doing his best to protect the interests of the Hungarian people. Yeah, why wouldn't you?
Well, that's the point, because our politicians, I think they're beholden to this international liberal order of human rights. I think that's more important to them than the country being successful, by a long way, actually. I think they're emotionally committed to human rights, whatever that's supposed to mean. And no, it doesn't matter what happens to the country. I mean, one of the things that Keir Starmer has demonstrated is that he has every sympathy for any villain because they're being oppressed by the state. As far as he's concerned, he used to go around the world trying to get child murderers off the death penalty for free because he thought that was bad. It's like, but you didn't think that when they were murdering a child, that child had the same right to life that you think the murderer has. And so it's very interesting how it's always the villain is the victim. And it's like, no, I don't believe it. The villain is the villain, and we are the good people who ought to do something about that. And we need to punish them.
Well, I think with the Hermers, the Starmers, and the Philippe Sandses sort of now embedded at the center of our sort of leadership, the lunatics truly are running the asylum, I'm afraid.
Oh, you can see it. Keir Starmer is one of his first acts.
But they may be malign lunatics. They may actually have a malign agenda at the same time, which I suspect they do.
It's not even may. I think it's open. I mean, Keir Starmer opening the prisons and letting out thieves and murderers in his first couple of weeks in power. This is like, what are you doing?
It's bizarre.
It's
bizarre.
Unbelievable. But I think we can agree that Restore Britain is on the pro-British side of the political argument.
Look, we if you look at, and I always say, watch what the hands are doing, not what the mouth is saying. If you look at what I've done throughout my life, I fought the Maastricht Treaty. I stood for the referendum party to save the pound. I then did a lot of business for Sterling, vote leave, set in the European Parliament. And here I am. I've just kept going because the establishment didn't respect the vote in 2016.
Mm.
I always want a sovereign nation state run from Westminster. And I've always had the view, unlike the post-war elite, that the nation state is the most important unit.
Mm.
And as we know, Europe didn't like that because France and Germany have a habit of trying to invade each other and the rest of Europe, which we, thankfully, we've never done. And we could have done after Waterloo, but we chose to trade with Europe freely, which is not what they're choosing to do with us now.
Mm.
So I believe Europe worked very well when it was a collection of cooperating nation states, occasionally warring nation states, but from war you get, and I'm not condoning war, but you actually get most of your innovation during war. And look at what's happening in Ukraine. You've got drone warfare, you know, both in the air and on the ground. It's developing very fast. War tends to create innovation. And yeah, it's not a good thing, but I think nation states are an accountable unit and ideally a cooperation amongst what I call accountable units is much better than a top-down sort of nanny-knows best statist block which oppresses its people. And I would argue that the 510 million or whatever it is European citizens are pretty oppressed.
I agree. I mean, if the European Union was a confederacy rather than a union, I'd have far fewer problems with it.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't operate in the way that it does. So anyway, let's move on. So What's next for the Restore Britain movement? Where, like, how do you see it interfacing with, say, other popular movements that exist in the country, or with the existing parties? How do you see it moving?
Well, I think we want to be a unifying force. I don't think, you know, people ask me about Advance UK. I didn't know Ben was going to be launching. He didn't tell me. I spoke to him a lot beforehand. He wanted a party. I wanted a movement. But look, I like Ben very much. I hope eventually we do end up working together. I don't particularly like the name Advance UK. As I've said in the past, I think it sounds like a toothpaste brand rather than a political party. But look, that was his decision.
I told him that too.
That was his decision.
I told him that's not a mine. Great name. Yeah.
But I think Ben is a decent man, and I want to unify and work with people like Ben, because I think he is a patriot, and I think at the end of the day. And there are many other patriots, and hopefully we can all get together now. Mm. And as I say, our country, our responsibility. But the problem we've had, I think, Carl, is that a lot of British people have probably had it too good since the war. Mm. They've taken their eye off the ball. They've probably been bribed with all sorts of quantitative easing, and they've been deluded by people putting sellotape over the cracks. And as I say, you can feel the country slipping away. So I think Restore Britain is an opportunity for people to show that they're concerned and actually do something about it. And if they don't, then, and they lose their country, don't come crying on my shoulder, because at the end of the day, I'm trying.
We all are.
I didn't choose to do this, really. I mean, I just feel I've got to do it. And one thing's led to another, and here I am. As I always think, very often the truth is weirder than fiction, and I think this is another example of that. And people ask me, well, how did you become chairman of Southampton Football Club? Well, I didn't start with a piece of paper and have a plan to become chairman of Southampton. It just happened.
Yeah.
And you know, I think with my life, I always seem to court controversy. I don't know why, because I think I'm pretty straightforward and easy to get on with, but there seems to be a general, wherever I go, I get sort of, I find I bump into authority and rules and regulations and laws, and all I'm trying to do is the best I can.
Mm.
And I would say in Parliament now, I think the sort of very bad development from the MP expenses scandal is that there is now a collection of extremely complex rules. I mean, I personally describe the parliamentary rule book as a rather like a homunculus. It's been thrown together, and it basically contradicts itself. It's not clear, but it does empower the parliamentary staff and disempower the MPs.
Mm.
It also is a disincentive for people to go and actually do things as an active MP, because they can always fall foul of some petty rule. And that shouldn't be the way. I mean, obviously we should have a commissioner on standards who is there to ultimately regulate and make sure people aren't being dishonest. But what you don't need is one that can subjectively fetter the way in which MPs go about their daily business. And MPs are elected by the people. They represent the people. They're a very, very important part of our democracy. But to some extent, they've been undermined.
And not by
accident.
And
that needs to change.
Either. Not by accident. So can I ask you about the Rape Gang inquiry? Because I see you posting about it, and I was wondering if you could give us an update.
Yeah, we've got next week in Parliament. This morning we've invited my fellow MPs to come and meet them. But we've actually got, I think it's about 30 girls. It may be a few more. We're not quite sure exactly how many. Coming down to Parliament. So 30 of the victims are coming down.
How many MPs have agreed to meet them?
Well, not, we haven't. We only sent the email out this morning, so they're coming down. We've had some great help from people who are supportive of us. We've got a very nice office locally that they're going to help basically put them up. Put them up in with a cup of tea and a sandwich.
Yeah.
And then they're going to come over to Parliament and everybody can meet with them. We're not going to have journalists there. This is just going to be an internal thing. But what we are finding, and I can't praise my team enough. They, you know, that's Sammy Woodhouse, as you know, and her friend called Natalie, who's basically doing a lot of the sort of welfare stuff, because a lot of this can be quite difficult for girls to actually have these have these tragedies brought back up, or these vile crimes, one should say. So I think what we have identified, this is happening everywhere. This is not happening just in a few places, Carl. I mean, we think this is happening in over 100 towns and cities across the country. And the state probably doesn't like what I've done. Maybe that's why they keep having a pop at me, because they tried to play the Good Samaritan, walk along the other side of the street, look the other way, and pretend this wasn't happening for reasons that are pretty obvious. You know, they didn't want to be called racists. They didn't want to admit that their post-war multicultural experiment had failed. And most of this had been happening in Labour wards, and they therefore didn't want in any way to expose the fact that the Muslim bloc vote was a very important part of Labour winning power.
I think that's actually one of the most important
big
parts.
So the postal voting system needs to be completely overhauled. It's a farce.
Yeah.
And it's open to basically complete abuse. So I think we are making good progress. Some people say to me, oh, well, now the government's agreed to have a statutory inquiry. You should step down and stop doing yours.
I'm sure they'll do a great job. I'm sure I can trust them.
Have we heard any more? Have we heard any plans? Have we heard any announcements about what the structure's going to be, what the timescale's going to be, how it's going to be run? No, we haven't.
No.
And this is the state marking its own homework.
Yes.
So, no, I am going to be there. We are going to continue with what we're doing, and we're going to hold them to account. We've only got a very small sum of money. I mean, I mean, we raised in all about £600,000. The Jay inquiry, I think, cost £186 million. So we are literally operating on a shoestring. I've got to give credit to all those people who gave whatever they gave, and some people gave, by their standards, a lot. Some people gave bigger donations, but to some people, smaller donations were a bigger cost. So, you know, thank you to everybody, because they clearly care deeply about this issue, and so they should. Because how can a society be at peace with itself when you've got this criminality basically embedded within our structure? It just doesn't work for me.
So I think a lot of people completely agree with you. But there seems to be a kind of looming unsaid question over the entire thing, which is, what did the community that this came from know about this? And what can be done to find a kind of moral balancing of the scales?
Well, I'm quite clear, and we're quite clear on this. I mean, I think if families knew that this was happening, or a member of the family was perpetrating it, I think they have to bear the responsibility for that. I mean, that is their duty with a vile crime like this, is to expose it, not to hide it. I mean, we're working with a group of people now to try and make sure we do get videos in taxis, because again, I think a lot of this is linked to the drug trade. And if if you think about it, a taxi sitting outside a house is not unusual. Whereas a private car sitting there, people might ask, what's that person doing sitting in the car?
Yeah.
So if you had cameras in the taxis, in every taxi, then you'd think the taxi drivers want it. If they're operating legally, why would they not want it? It protects them. So we're trying to do that, but there's a resistance to that, which immediately makes me concerned. So we're working to achieve that. There's a lot of things coming out of the rape gang inquiry, which I think hopefully will improve things. But the most important thing is that the state admits that it has presided over something which should never have been allowed to happen. And that goes to, I mean, almost every organ in the state, whether it's the doctors in the NHS must have known it's happening. Social services must have known it was happening. The police definitely knew it was happening. And I think one of the reasons why they didn't want a statutory inquiry is if they link all the police databases, they're going to find there's a pattern there. So they didn't want to do that. They wanted to silo it all so nobody actually could see the extent of the problem. Mm. And when Sadiq Khan tries to sort of suggest it isn't happening in London, which I think he did, I mean, that's just a farce. Of course it's happening in London. It's still happening now.
Yeah.
So I've, you know, we've got a great team here. I mean, Sammy Woodhouse is a dynamo and she's done a great job. So in answer to your question, we're making progress. We are identifying victims. We are going to have a hearing in due course when we're ready. And we will produce a report. We issued a term of reference and we're going to try and deliver that.
Have you got a rough timescale for this?
We don't have a firm timescale, no, because we've got to do the job as properly as we can.
Right.
And I think depending on when the state comes up with its statutory inquiry and what the terms of reference are, which I haven't seen yet of you.
No.
And it all boils down, as you know, to the terms of reference because you can the wrong terms of reference can hide an awful lot of things.
Would you like to explain how that works for people who aren't aware?
What terms of reference?
Yeah, and how it hides things.
Well, if you have a like we put out a statement as to how we were going to run it, and that's what we're trying to stick to. Mm-hmm. The government needs to put out a statement of how they're going to operate the statutory inquiry. It needs to be transparent, as we know. Transparency is good. Opacity is bad. I think let's see what they come up with. I mean, it's as simple as that, really. If you get the terms of reference wrong, you're never going to get a fair inquiry. And I think take a look at COVID. The COVID inquiry for me was a farce.
Oh, yeah.
It was never going to come up with the right decision. It's not looked at everything it should have looked at. And again, I think the state, as I said in the TCW interview, which I sent you, the state is now the enemy of the people, and you only have to look at the post office inquiry. Post office submasters still haven't been paid the compensation, which is a disgrace. People haven't been compensated in the infected blood scandal, for the Gulf War jabs, for, you know, almost anything the state touches, it makes bad decisions, and then it fails to either accept the fact they were bad, and I think COVID is an example of this, and then put right what they got wrong.
So the underwriting theme of all of this is a lack of accountability.
Totally. Totally. There is. Do you see any accountability?
No, none at all. like the idea that the rape gangs, for example, could operate for decades unchecked, and not one police officer or councillor or MP has been held to account for this at all, is just shocking. Absolutely shocking.
And then you juxtapose that against, you know, the police taking seriously two palpably false witness statements against me, wasting a load of police time. And arguably, if they treated it differently, I could have been one of those innocent men in prison. That's pretty frightening.
And there are so many people in the country who are on the wrong side of the state, and they find themselves getting persecuted. If I may, I'd like to ask you about Tommy Robinson, because he is intending to do a rally in September this year, and I think he's made it very public that he's asked you to appear. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I praised Tommy Robinson for what he did on the rape gangs, and Gordon Rayner at The Telegraph got upset because I think he felt that was not justified, and I don't agree with him. I think if somebody's done something valuable and is being proved correct, which Tommy Robinson has, you should give him credit for that. Mm. I don't quite understand why the state has this pathological hatred for Tommy Robinson. I don't know much about him. I've never met him. I've never spoken to him.
He's a nice enough guy.
I quite like him. I think he cares about his country, clearly.
Yeah.
But all politicians seem to want to avoid him like the plague. So I think from my point of view, I'm grateful for what he's done in that respect. I think what I want to do is unify. Mm. And what I will do, and you're quite right, he's asked if I would speak, but I've got to do and work out what is the best course to unity,
yeah.
I think.
I
unity is the most important thing. Mm. We want to avoid division.
Mm.
Division is not going to help us now.
Mm. No, I understand, because Tommy Robinson is used by the state and the political class as a totemic figure in the resentment and the just resentment that the working class has against the liberal establishment. They are the ones who have borne the burden of being the victims of the rape gangs. They're the ones who have borne the burden of the uncontrolled mass immigration that no one asked
Correct.
For.
Taking their jobs away.
Absolutely. But not just the jobs as well. The social struggle that it's been to find your community displaced and replaced with a new community that often isn't very polite to you, is actually kind of hostile towards you. I met a woman from Hull when I was doing my MEP campaign in Devon. And she said, well, I had to flee because I felt the Pakistani community was racist towards us. They just hated us. And it's these sort of low-level daily interactions that you don't hear about because they don't make the news, but make life very unpleasant.
Well, for those people, Carl, I would say, for those people who who don't know it,
yeah,
people should go and study the history of Lebanon.
Yes, absolutely.
Because Lebanon is your...
Yeah.
That's your playbook.
And I think that's why they hate Tommy Robinson so much, because in him, all of the nexus of this betrayal is made evident. He's become a kind of totemic figure for the working class to stand against the current paradigm and say, this is what you've done to us. And essentially, if they say, oh, okay, yeah, good point, then they admit that they're all culpable for all of the horrors that have been visited on the British people. And Tommy really, his crime is being correct about all of this and presenting it to
I think them. It was in Luton, wasn't it? He saw it happening in Luton.
Yes.
In
one of his cousins.
Very early on,
one
early
of his cousins
2000s.
Was, was a victim of it. And he's become a kind of collective lightning rod. So I totally understand that you're reluctant to be divisive over it, because to the establishment, he does represent the ghosts of all of the victims. And so,
I don't think we want to let the establishment divide and rule us. Well, and I therefore don't think we want to give them any ammunition with which to do that. So I think we have to be sensible and unifying.
Yes, but I also I'm not trying to suggest that you should or shouldn't do anything, but I think that allowing them to control what rallies you speak at is also playing into the divide and rule a little bit. So it's just something to think about. I'm not saying you should do anything or anything like that, but and I'm not saying, you know, there's a time and a place for everything, right? And so, you know, I'm sure you'll make sensible decisions.
I will listen
decisions.
To your wise counsel, Carl.
I appreciate it. I'm sure you'll make sensible decisions. But while this is still a consideration, the establishment is still dividing and ruling us under that thing. So that's all I'll say on it. Right, so what's next? What are you doing next?
Well, I'm so busy that I can hardly sit down, and
I've from one day to
made
another.
This joyful visit to Swindon, especially to see you this morning on my way down.
And I very much appreciate
get home.
It.
I mean, there's lots going on. I mean, we have so much going on. We've got a very small team. I think as we get what I call the ammo into restore, so we can start to develop policy more deeply. And I think very often people in Parliament just talk and then don't deliver. And what we want to do is we want to have the ability to actually develop the policy rather than just putting out a little header. We need to know a bit more of the details. So that's one thing we're very keen to do. We want to protect or we want to develop private prosecutions. I think private prosecutions, a bit like you know, having a jury trial, it's a very powerful tool. People don't use private prosecutions very much, but I think they are particularly powerful. And what we want to also do is set up a whistleblowing unit. So, because I think now with the size of the state, we're already getting people who, because there are a lot of decent people in the country, even those who are indentured into the statist system.
Yes.
But they care about their country too, but they're trapped. But, you know, they've got families, they've got Yeah. They've got responsibilities and they can't necessarily kick against the system. That's what the system relies on. That's why it doesn't like high-minded, independent, wealthy individuals who can challenge the status quo. So we want to set up a whistleblower, and if we can start to identify where the state is being fraudulent or where it is breaking the law, where it is not serving the interests of the British people, we might decide that we're going to take out some private prosecutions. We might not. But if we've got the tools and we've got
the looming threat, the ammunition, might be enough.
We can start to we can start to affect the change. That's why Restore Britain is so important as a movement.
Yeah, no, I agree.
So I think, look, there's lots of stuff. And again, I'm, this is what it's taught me. I mean, even at 67, there's a lot I don't know. A bit like the reform guy who's running the Warwickshire County Council at the age of 18 with a budget of £400 million. When I was 18, I thought I knew all the answers. Now I'm 67, I now know I knew none of them.
Yeah.
So the answer is this guy probably thinks he knows what he's doing, but trust me, he doesn't. In the same way that MPs in Parliament don't. So look, this is to some extent a learning curve, and I think this is another sort of arrogant mistake that politicians make, is when people fire a question at them, they go, "We're going to do boom, 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 boom." Half the time, they haven't got a clue.
Yeah.
So why say you've got a clue? If you're sound, you're rather like water flows downhill. You will find the solution.
Yeah.
But you don't always know where you're going to find it or how you're going to deliver that solution.
And I think
I don't. Again, you're quite keen on, you know, we got to have a plan.
Well, no. I have to ask.
I'm less clear that there is a plan. I think the plan will evolve. Well, it is evolving fast.
If it helps, it's just my job as an interviewer to ask the questions, right? But I'm actually very much like you. I didn't have a plan. I've never had a plan.
It's all here.
Well, I know, but
the results here.
I know, but it wasn't planned, right? But the thing is, this is the old English way. We muddle through. We look at where we are.
Correct.
What would actually be the right thing to do? And the right thing tends to pay dividends. So you just do the best you can with what you have, and suddenly you realise that actually things, you look back and go, oh no, things turned out rather well actually.
Well, a bit like a farmer might have a plan to grow a field of wheat like he did this year in my case.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't rain, so you don't grow much wheat.
Well, at least your fields aren't waterlogged.
That's the great thing about farming, it keeps you humble. You cannot have these highfalutin plans that then come to nothing, because Mother Nature has a way of bringing you back down to size. And I think that's why I like farming so much.
That's interesting. Thank you so much for coming in. Obviously, everyone go and join Restore Britain. Follow Restore Britain on Twitter. Follow Rupert on Twitter. And go and help out and do whatever it is you can. I mean, I'm sure any number of volunteers.
We're getting lots of offers of help. Again, that's why we need a structure to start to garner that as well. So, I think the most important thing now is sign up. Encourage your family, your friends, your community. Get everybody to sign up. If you share the view that you can feel your country slipping through your fingers, that you want it back, that you want to restore Britain, sign up.
Yeah. And I've signed up, obviously. I signed up on day one. Once we reach a critical mass. And the thing is as well, what's come through on all of this is that it's a general project of accountability for the British people, because there is no accountability in public life. And this is really the only actual, like you say, non-partisan, non-divisive project that just works in the favour of the British people to hopefully bring some sort of accountability. But anyway, thank you again so much for coming in, and we'll see you in the future, hopefully.
Great to see you again.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.